Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. Following the murders of three Israeli teenagers and the grisly revenge killing of a young Palestinian, we'll begin with the volatile situation in Israel and Palestine as Hamas fires rockets at Israel and Israel's Air Force retaliates with strikes on Gaza. Award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, joins us to discuss demonstrations across Israel by right-wing youths chanting death to Arabs, as Justice Minister Tzipi Livni warns Israelis against incitement that leads to so-called price tag attacks against Arabs. Then we will speak with Rachel Stoll, a senior associate with the Stimson Center and the project director of their just-released recommendations and report on the Stimson Task Force on U.S. drone policy. She joins us to discuss the bipartisan panel of former senior intelligence and military officials that finds the Obama administration's embrace of targeted killings with drones is putting the U.S. on a slippery slope into perpetual war while setting a dangerous precedent for lethal operations that other countries might adopt in the future. Then finally, we will speak with John Hope Bryant, the founder and CEO of Operation Hope and Bryant Group Companies. He was chairman of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability Subcommittee on the Underserved and Community Empowerment, and was recently appointed by President Obama as a member of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans. We will discuss his new book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class, and look into how the poor and all consumers can take power over the economy and their lives. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be on with you, Ian.
And clearly, violence and retribution is continuing in Israel following the kidnapping and subsequent murder of three teenage Israeli boys and then the grisly murder and retaliation of a Palestinian boy. And then, of course, the rocket attacks from Gaza, which then invite Israeli airstrikes, which killed a number of Hamas militants. What's your sense of whether this will spiral out of control?
It already has spiraled out of control, Ian, and the primary culprit is Netanyahu and the right-wingers in his coalition through their response to the discovery of the bodies of the three Israeli teens. Netanyahu in particular called for blood vengeance, citing a turn-of-the-century poem by Chaim Bialik, the Hebrew poet, about a pogrom of Jews in Kishinev in the Pale of Settlement, and invoking this historical persecution of Jews gave Israelis the sense that a second Holocaust could occur in their society unless they lashed out at Palestinians, who Netanyahu is portrayed as the heirs to the Nazis and to the pogromists of the turn of the century Europe. It was an incredibly irresponsible, disgusting statement, and immediately in Jerusalem, mobs of Israeli youth who are comprehensively indoctrinated in a heavily militarized society poured out in the streets chanting death to Arabs and Muhammad is dead. And the burning alive of Muhammad Abu Khuder from Shufat, just in East Jerusalem, by a group of these Israeli thugs who met at one of these death to Arabs rallies, was the inevitable outcome. The chaos shows no sign of ebbing, and Netanyahu has completely lost control of the situation.
But on the other hand, Netanyahu has called for calm. He has apologized to the parents of the slain boy, or the immolated boy. And Israeli Justice Minister Tzipi Livni has gone on television talking about how the Israelis have got to act on the smallest signs of incitement, whether it is on internet sites or price tag attacks, not just between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It is within Israel, between different Israeli citizens. And this is what worries me the most. So,
well, Livni's... Yeah, go ahead.
Now, what do you make of that?
Well, Livni's a bit player in the government. She is, you know, the kind of great white hope of the fading, enlightened, liberal Israeli society. and controls about six seats in the Knesset, and she's basically been installed as cover for Netanyahu and the extremists in his coalition, like Naftali Bennett and Avigdor Lieberman, who's the second most popular politician, who has called for ethnic cleansing in the light of the discovery of the three Israeli teens' bodies. But what you're talking about is a complete mainstreaming of annihilationist racism towards Palestinians that's being produced through the Israeli educational system. This killing and burning alive of Abu Khader is not unique. It happened in 2012 when Jamal Julani, a 19-year-old Palestinian, was beaten into a coma by mobs of Israeli youth in the middle of central Jerusalem. In the middle of Jerusalem, while hundreds of people stood by and watched, a year before, a Palestinian boy was killed, stabbed to death in the same location. And there are common threads in all of these killings. These youth have been influenced by an anti-miscegenation movement, which is burgeoning inside Israeli society right now and incites against Jewish-Arab relationships and has received government money and has support within the governing coalition. And they're fans of the Beitar Jerusalem Football Club, which features chanting of death to Arabs after every goal and is sort of a central node of right-wing organizing, and also happens to be the favorite football team of Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman. The killers of Mohammed Abu Khader have been identified as Beitar Jerusalem fanatics. And if you hang out in Jerusalem enough at the Malchah Mall near where Beitar Jerusalem games take place, you will occasionally see young hooligans riot through the mall looking for Arab workers to attack. So what we're seeing right now isn't unique. It's just an escalation of trends that have been building for years, which I described in my book, Goliath, and which I was harshly attacked for detailing.
Again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. So what is this term then, price tag attacks, that Israeli Justice Minister Tzipi Livni referred to?
Well, price tag refers to the price that hilltop youth, radical young settlers attempt to impose on the Israeli government for demolishing a hilltop outpost settlement. And it's just a way of, they'll conduct a terror attack against Palestinians and try to inflame the situation. They call it price tag, and they'll spray paint Tag Mahir, which is Hebrew for price tag, on the Palestinian home or church or mosque that they vandalize, and try to pressure the Israeli government not to dismantle their settlements. But it's gone way beyond anything relating to settlements. We're now seeing price tag attacks inside core Israeli cities. In Jaffa, 5 minutes south of Tel Aviv, yesterday, a group of settlers rampaged through this city, and right-wing extremists rampaged through the city, attacking Palestinian young men and nearly inflaming riots. The violence that we're seeing right now is not occurring in the West Bank. It's occurring in Haifa, where right-wing racist mobs are rampaging through mixed areas, chanting death to Arabs, and it's occurring in Jerusalem. And it's not just being carried out by vigilantes. It's also being carried out by uniformed Israeli police, who, when they take off their uniforms, often join these vigilante mobs. I've been informed that the mourning tent, where the family of Mohammed Abu Khader is mourning their son, who was burned alive and forced to drink gasoline, was just attacked by Israeli border police with percussion grenades and tear gas. So the chaos is really taking place in the interior of Israel. In the West Bank, it is the occupation subcontractor of the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas who are really keeping Palestinian resistance and rioting under wraps. And the West Bank is completely quiet right now.
So, Max Blumenthal, why is it then that you're about the only person in the entire American press that discusses these issues? So you would think that, and as Netanyahu himself said, that the difference between us and our neighbors is that they consider murderers to be heroes. Now,
right.
That is the refrain, that the Arabs are the mad dogs and the Israelis are the noble, suffering people. And you're painting a reverse picture. You're saying that there's quiet on the West Bank, not in Gaza, of course, and that there are raging mobs of right-wing, bloodthirsty fanatics on the streets of Israel.
Yeah, my book paints a picture of a society that has been consumed and overcome with eliminationist racism that's inflamed from the highest levels of government. One of the rising figures in the Jewish Home Party, which is the third most popular party in Israel and a key member of Netanyahu's governing coalition, her name is Ayelet Shaked, and she's really the face of Israeli youth. She's captured the hearts and minds of Israeli youth. She's not a settler. She lives inside Israel, and she just published on Facebook a call for the genocide of Palestinians in no uncertain terms. And this call received tens of thousands of likes from Israelis. Even before the bodies of the three Israeli teens were discovered, a Facebook page was spontaneously created called The People of Israel Demand Revenge. It called for the execution of one Palestinian for each day the teens were missing. It received 35,000 likes in just a few days. And this is in a very small tribal society of like less than 5 or 6 million Israeli Jews. So that's a substantial portion of social media users under the age of 30. And I wrote about these trends in my book. These Facebook pages are nothing new. There have been pages dedicated to the assassination of Palestinian-Israeli lawmakers who are deemed traitors, while the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, calls them a fifth column, a Trojan horse, and traitors. So it really is frustrating to me that I've spent years talking about these trends of racism, of what many of my left-wing Israeli friends call fascism, and that I was attacked so harshly by figures like Eric Alterman, that I was smeared, that there was this campaign to kind of suppress what I was writing, or that it was ignored by the New York Times. And now the mask is lifting. The illusions of liberal Zionism are in the open. And this is a time of crisis for people who believe that there was a good Israel that could rescue the country from within.
So I guess to some extent you've explained why it is that you're the only person in the entire American media reporting on this growth of right-wing extremism within Israel. Is there anybody else that's particularly in Israel that's reporting on this?
Well, there are. I mean, this is a great time, I think, for media because of the atomization of mainstream media and the challenge that it's facing from online media. So there are excellent websites that I write for. And including websites from inside Israel. One great website is MondoWeiss.net, which is really a Jewish-American progressive website that's heavily critical of what's happening in Israel right now. ElectronicIntifada.net, run by Ali Abu Nima, is, I think, the premier website on covering the situation in Israel-Palestine from a Palestinian perspective. 972 Mag is an excellent Israeli publication run by Israeli dissidents that does a lot of public translation of Hebrew media and has been covering the crisis that's been spiraling for the last 2 weeks really excellently. And finally, Haaretz is, you know, the voice of the Israeli enlightened liberal public. Most of its audience is actually in the United States now. And I feel like some of the editorials that they've been publishing, official editorials, have kind of vindicated my analysis of Israeli society. And in their most recent editorial on this crisis, they said Israel needs a cultural revolution. It needs to completely be changed from without and from within. And that the problem is that for 66 years, it's been an exclusively Jewish state that is undemocratic. And that's led straight to the current crisis. So I think, you know, we really need to take, when we're looking at, you know, these crises, it's important to follow it day to day and take advantage of all of the excellent online media outlets we have. But it's also important to take a broader view and look at the framework of Israeli society and the state of Israel and how it makes such horrors inevitable.
Well, speaking of Haaretz, Max Blumenthal, I spoke a few days ago, it was, with Gideon Levy, who is on the editorial board and writes a column on the West Bank and used to be Shimon Peres's spokesperson. He said in a question to him about the Israeli left and the peace movement, he said, forget about it. It's all, they're dead. It's gone. And he said the two-state solution is gone. He's given up on it. And I said, well, what's left? He said the one-state solution. And of course, that's a non-starter. So is there just total despair? Or are there people, you know, standing up for more enlightened politics in Israel?
Well, Gideon Levy's right, and he understands from inside. His trajectory is incredible, from being a Labor Party apparatchik to someone who's calling for a boycott of the state of Israel in order to save it from apartheid. And that's what the situation is. The two-state solution is dead. No real state has ever been offered to Palestinians, and that's been exposed in the latest round of negotiations with John Kerry. John Kerry's really pathetic framework attempt. But, you know, the issue isn't whether there is an element inside Israeli society that can save it from within. The issue has moved to the outside. And there is a campaign that is gathering strength, that is producing real victories through nonviolent tactics, and that's the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And it's not about despairing and beating chests and garment rending. It's about taking concrete action against apartheid that I think will actually open democratic space inside Israel once young Israelis see that voting for the right wing and acting out all of these revenge fantasies has a political price and that they can't do it anymore. And once liberal Israelis in Tel Aviv see that they can no longer ignore the crisis, that it's affecting them too because they can't go to rock concerts, they can't go to pop concerts, they can't see theater because people are boycotting them because they're holding millions of people in bondage, once they see that there's a political price, the situation will begin to change from within. There's a poll today published by Haaretz that shows that 42% of Jewish Israelis have never even met a Palestinian because of this regime of separation that the U.S. is funding and enforcing. So the issue is, when will pressure come from the outside, and where is the Israeli de Klerk to negotiate the end of this system? There will not be an Israeli de Klerk unless, first, there is an enormous price for the kind of system Israelis are carrying out.
So when Gideon Levy says, you know, the choice is either to become a South Africa or a one-state solution, what you're telling us is that already it's heading in the direction of South Africa, and it's also likely to invite the response that South African apartheid system did, which was an international boycott that eventually brought about the end of the regime. So that's the trajectory that you're suggesting.
This isn't a choice. It isn't about a choice. The current reality is that everyone between the river and the sea is living under the control of one state, and that they are given rights according to their ethnicity and religion, and that those who are not Jewish or Palestinian either have no rights or have very limited rights. It is a system of apartheid, and it is a unitary one state. Just because there are walls doesn't mean there are actual borders. There are no internationally recognized borders. So the issue is, what kind of single state will there be? The issue is not about land for peace, it's about rights. And that's where the discourse is going to. Israelis are being forced to decide whether they want to live in a single state with no rights for Palestinians, or in a single state or some kind of confederation with equal rights. When people warn that the situation could become apartheid, that's like me warning that I could be talking to you on a telephone. Like, I'm currently on the phone with you. It's currently apartheid, and in a lot of ways, it's worse than the South African situation, because apartheid South Africa needed black South Africans as exploited cheap labor. The state of Israel does not need Palestinians. They've transformed Palestinians into human surplus and are warehousing them in the Gaza Strip, denying them the right to even have an economy, and that's the root of the violence that we're seeing from the Gaza Strip, is that they have been turned into a kind of subhuman class who have no value and no right to even leave or export goods.
So just in closing then, Max Blumenthal, going back to the beginning, given that the situation has clearly alarmed the Prime Minister Netanyahu, who you hold largely responsible for what's happening, what do you think, and I've quoted the Justice Minister as suggesting that her real concern is Israelis turning on Israelis. What is your sense then of how this might be resolved, at least in the short term, you know, bearing in mind everything you've talked about in terms of Israel becoming like South Africa and inviting an international boycott?
I don't see this being resolved in the short term. I see a very long game. I see more and more Americans, including Jewish Americans, led by organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, rising to the occasion and getting behind the campaign to boycott, divest from, and sanction the Israeli government and companies involved in the occupation. And this will bear positive fruit in the future. But for now, we're going to witness some very despairing images on the ground. The U.S. refuses to put any pressure on the Israeli government and is sanctioning the entire thing with its pathetic statements of concern. Finally, the Palestinian Authority bears a huge amount of blame. It's kept the West Bank under lock and key on behalf of the Israeli government, and Palestinians in the West Bank have no ability to resist their occupation or to make their voices heard in the international sphere.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Max Blumenthal.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about U.S. drone policy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rachel Stoll, who's a senior associate with the Stimson Center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative, where she focuses on issues relating to the international arms trade, including small arms and light weapons, as well as children in armed conflict. She is the author of The International Arms Trade and The Beginner's Guide to the Small Arms Trade, and is the project director of the Stimson Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy, who just released a report, Recommendations and Report on the Stimson Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Stoll.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And the group that you assembled, that you were the project director on, includes a number of senior, first of all, it was chaired by General John Abizaid and Rosa Brooks at the Georgetown Law School. It included Lincoln Bloomfield, Missy Cummings, Janine Davidson, Peter Lichtbaum, Philip Mudd, and Jeffrey Smith. Some of those names I know. Philip Mudd, former senior CIA official. Jeffrey Smith, former National Security Council official. Who are the others?
Sure. We had John Bellinger, who's a former senior associate counsel to the president and legal advisor to the National Security Council and legal advisor to the State Department under the Bush administration. We had Lieutenant General Dave Barno, who was a former head of the Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan. You mentioned Link Bloomfield, who's not only Stimson's board chair, but also was a former Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs. Missy Cummings is an associate professor of mechanical engineering and material science at Duke, herself a former U.S. Navy pilot. Janine Davidson is currently a senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, but she was previously a deputy assistant secretary of defense for plans and a former Air Force pilot. Peter Lichtenbaum, who's an attorney and partner at Covington & Burling, was a former acting undersecretary of commerce for industry and security. Phil Mudd, you mentioned, was not only at the CIA, but also was deputy director of national security for the FBI. And Jeff Smith, who's currently with Arnold & Porter, was former general counsel of the CIA and former general counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and a former JAG officer for the Army. So you can see we have not only a very esteemed panel, but a panel who really had immense experience in the national security realm, in the counterterrorism realm, that served a variety of presidents, not just one president or two presidents. And we had those who were really from both sides of the aisle. So we didn't want this to just be bipartisan. We really wanted it to be nonpartisan.
Well, but what's extraordinary about the report, Rachel Stoll, is that the report finds that the Obama administration's embrace of targeted killings using armed drones is putting the United States on a slippery slope into a perpetual war and setting a dangerous precedent for lethal operations that other countries might adopt in the future. That's a pretty alarming finding.
Right. Well, what I think is really interesting about this report is that it didn't pull any punches. It really said, look, we're going to take this issue seriously. We're going to examine the facts as we have them. And I think one of the other conclusions is that we don't have all the facts. So it's really hard to make assessments and judgments on a lot of aspects of the targeted killing program, for example. But that when we do have the facts, the rationale that we're using is not only a slippery slope for the United States, but is really potentially setting a dangerous precedent. And what I mean by that is that if another country that perhaps was not a friend to the United States said, we're going to go after these separatists who we've decided are threats to our sovereignty, but we're really not going to tell you very much about them. We're not going to tell you why. Just trust us. These are bad guys, and we need to take them out. That would not sit well with us, whether that was Russia about Ukrainian separatists who were against Russian interference in that country, whether it was China and some Taiwanese sympathizers. It really, that just would not work for the United States.
So what did this report find? I don't know that you had a psychiatrist on the panel, but what I find interesting is that almost all of my progressive friends are absolutely outraged by drones, and it really bothers them deeply. So I'm trying to understand that emotion, as well as apparently, as this report indicates, that the blowback of these drones is that it outrages these people that we're striking so much that they become terrorists again. So they kill terrorists, but they also at the same time recruit other terrorists because of the outrage that they provoke. So that's something that I find personally puzzling, because, I'm not sure I think it seems to me that killing people is a bad idea no matter what. But I don't understand the difference, if you will, between, is it more honorable to stick a bayonet in somebody's gut and watch them die than it is to zap somebody with a drone?
Sure. I think, drones are a very emotional issue. What we tried to do with the task force was take out not only the emotion, but the rhetoric, and not say all drones are bad or all drones are good, but really to say that there is a time and a place, that it's a technology that we can use as a tactic. It is not a strategy in and of itself, and that there may be times when these are appropriate tools in a very large military or foreign policy toolbox, and there may be times when they are not such good tools. And we really tried to unpack the difference and to try and figure out what do we know about this technology, how could we use it in the future to prevent things like blowback from creating additional enemies, and when could it be a very useful tool for extending maybe our operational reach, our precision, our persistence, the ability to loiter and collect intelligence. There are very positive attributes to these weapons. The problem is when you don't know about something, you tend to be very suspicious. So I think on both the, for drones side and the perhaps the against drone side, there's a lot of emotion that plays into it. What we tried to do with the task force is to dispel some of the common misconceptions about the technology so that we could have an honest conversation. So, these are not, for example, a super weapon that's going to eliminate the need for all conventional war and we'll never have to put boots on the ground again. That doesn't make any sense. They are not, most UAVs themselves are not weaponized. They are used for a variety of purposes, whether it's, as I mentioned, intelligence, but also for humanitarian assistance. If you're After the typhoon in the Philippines, there were drones that were used to see what runways were safe, where masses of people were collecting, so that you could provide humanitarian aid. In California, last year, they were used to help with the forest fires that were threatening so many people and structures. So, you know, really trying to look at these weapons and the technology behind them in a clear way, to try and avoid some of the problems that are, you know, the potential problems like the blowback you mentioned, but also to try and figure out when are they an appropriate tool.
Again, I'm speaking with Rachel Stoll, who's a senior associate with the Stimson Center's Managing Across Boundaries Initiative, where she focuses on issues relating to the international arms trade, including small arms and light weapons, as well as children and armed conflict. She is the author of The International Arms Trade and The Beginner's Guide to the Small Arms Trade, and is the project director of the Stimson Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy, who just released a report, recommendations and report on the Stimson Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy. So I still would like to get a feeling, though, for, you know, the idea that in Pakistan, in the tribal areas, when the U.S. targets a Taliban fighter or leader or whatever, or a high-value target, as they call them, and there's quite often what they call collateral damage. What happens, though, to those fighters? Because maybe you can hear the drones. I believe you can. I believe it's a snowmobile engine that they have. So maybe you can hear them.
I would call it an angry lawnmower is the sound. When I heard a Predator drone, to me it sounded like an angry lawnmower.
Right, right. But at the same time, you know, the idea that we have a superior weapon to the, you know, it's like goes back to the frontier days of the Remington being superior to the bow and arrow of the Native American. It doesn't seem to be working in terms of making people stop what they're doing. It seems to be making them want to fight us even more. So I'm trying to understand that mechanism.
Sure. And then one of the things that the report says is that we need to have a cost-benefit analysis of whether these things are working, as you said, or are they creating more animosity, more anti-U.S. sentiment? And we really haven't had a systematic examination of that very issue. What we do know anecdotally is that in many cases, even though drone strikes are much more precise than, say, you know, dropping a bomb from an F-16, for example, even though they're far more precise and they have had relatively few civilian casualties, there are still civilian casualties, there is still collateral damage, and the idea of them really has angered entire communities, and that has increased anti-U.S. sentiment, and it has become a potent recruiting tool for terrorist organizations. And what we're also seeing is that there's a backlash in states that haven't directly been affected by strikes, but because of other issues that they are concerned about. So whether it's sovereignty or a lack of transparency or even things like accountability, because we know so little, because the U.S. government has released so little data about who has been targeted, for what purpose, in what way, it's at what time, et cetera, people become very suspicious, and you can't hold people to account, and you don't know who is responsible. That in and of itself engenders a backlash, not only from people in those affected countries, but from countries that are our allies, and even from the American public itself.
And as you pointed out, it's just a trust me basis, right?
Right.
We have to, you know, we don't know how they come up with these targeting lists and what who they decide to go after and what the real results are.
Right. And we weren't trying to say that the Obama administration or the Bush administration prior was doing anything nefarious. It's the question of when you don't know, right, you have questions. And so what we were saying was if you provide that information, even in the aggregate, there may be national security reasons that you can't provide all of the data on all of the individual strikes. But if you start to provide that aggregate, particularly since in some cases the theater has been, you know, it's 13 years that we've been operating in, you begin to provide some confidence in what you're doing, in the rationale, and, you know, the values that the Obama administration has laid out, the president has said in two different speeches over the last year and a half, those sound really good, and I'd like to believe that those are true. And so I think that that can help build some confidence in what the U.S. is doing, and more importantly, set an example for other countries of the proper way to conduct these kinds of operations.
Well, the president gave a speech a year ago promising new guidelines for drone strikes and greater transparency about them. So presumably your report will force some more transparency. At least I imagine that is the hope, right?
That is the hope. I mean, we didn't want this report to just be another report sitting on a shelf. We wanted it to be read. And we provided recommendations that, although we're idealistic, we're really pragmatic. And so many of them were things that could be done in the short term that wouldn't require a tremendous amount of policy change or congressional activity that the president could do easily. Some of them are going to require a little more effort. But the idea here was to have, you know, reasonable, sustainable, practical suggestions for the administration. And I think we accomplished that. But I also think that we wanted to try and change the conversation that was happening in this country and around the world, in that we wanted to say, let's take the emotion outside of this conversation. Let's take the rhetoric outside, and let's really focus on the issues at hand. And when we can do that, then we find that we have really common ground. I think the makeup of our task force demonstrates that you don't need to have people from the same political ideology. You really just need people to look at this issue from a common sense approach and come up with practical solutions to a complex problem.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rachel Stoll.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Rachel Stoll, who's a senior associate with the Stimson Center's Managing Across Boundaries Initiative, where she focuses on issues relating to the international arms trade, including small arms and light weapons, as well as children and armed conflict. She's the author of The International Arms Trade and The Beginner's Guide to the Small Arms Trade, and was project director of the Stimson Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy, who just released a report, recommendations and report on the Stimson Task Force on U.S. drone policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the poor can save capitalism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Hope Bright, the founder, chairman, and CEO of Operation Hope and Bright Group Companies, recognized as one of Time Magazine's 50 for the Future Leaders. Bright is the author of Love Leadership and is the only African-American best-selling business author. In 2014, he was appointed by President Obama as a member of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans and is also the co-founder of the Gallup Hope Index, the only national research poll on youth financial dignity and youth economic energy in the United States. His latest book just out is How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Hope Bright.
I'm deeply honored to be here with you.
And first of all, back in 2008, 2009, in effect, the middle class saved capitalism, did they not? Or the average American, in as much as we bailed out Wall Street, who essentially got off for taking the global economy to a near-death experience and were made whole. And now, arguably, Wall Street is too bigger to fail, as some say, and Main Street is languishing. So given that recent history, is it really up to the poor to save capitalism?
Well, whether it's up to the poor or not, we already are. I mean, the reality is that 70% of the economy is consumer spending today. I mean, that's just a fact. the reality is that half of Americans live at $50,000 a year of income or below. That's a fact. And then 90% of every one of those dollars goes back into the economy because people who make $50,000 a year or less can't afford not to spend it. That's also a fact. So whether we want to save capitalism or not, and I think we should, and I'll explain why in a moment, the reality is that we are. Now, let's deal with the horrible nature of capitalism. You just gave, of course, one great example. We have a big pop every 10 years or so of a recession or some scandal, a Madoff or something that sends the economy into a tailspin. This last one, the Great Recession, is probably the best since the Great Depression, probably the worst since the Great Depression. So all those things are horrible, and everything you just said was, of course, correct. But there is no perfect, Ian. I mean, I tell my friends who say, oh, America is a horrible place. I say, okay, great. Tell me perfect. Let's go there. And I wait, and, of course, there's no response. Okay, capitalism is a horrible system. Yeah, it's a horrible system, just like democracy, except for every other system. China, a communist country, has selected capitalism as its vehicle. Russia, a communist country, has selected capitalism as its vehicle. Socialism won't work in America. It will work in some small Nordic countries. 3 million, 5 million population won't work with 300 million people. We're stuck with an imperfect reality. But it's not capitalism that's bad. It's the virtues and the values behind it that's bad. As the Bible says, it's not money that's evil. It's the love of money that's evil. So I think that capitalism needs an upgrade, a software upgrade. I think that there's no better person or group of people that's better able to give them that moral upgrade than the generation of young people coming through now who've seen people focus on me and not we. Who I think are looking for a rainbow after this storm. I mean, the folks after the Great Depression were seared by what they saw their parents go through, and that was arguably the biggest rise, Ian, we've had ever. I mean, that 50-year period of the Great Depression is the totality almost of the American story. It certainly was where we, the middle class, really rose. So I believe that for our own enlightened self-interest, we've got to make a better adaptation of capitalism, because in my study of the world, and I've been over 100 countries, I can't find another country that's got it better than we do. When we get it right, we get it really right.
Well, let's talk then about what's happening in this country, particularly politically, and how that translates to your call to having the poor save capitalism, John Hope Bryant. The Census Bureau just published a report indicating that the southern states are becoming a huge block of poverty in this country and that there are some pockets in the Midwest. But the number of Americans living in poverty areas has skyrocketed from 49.5 million, or 18.1% of the population in 2000, to at least 77 million, or 25.7% in 2010. So how do you deal with this paradox that in these southern states, particularly white Americans, vote for Republican politicians who are cutting the social safety net while impoverishing the states?
Actually, that's a bit of a ruse. With those particular candidates, I hasten to say Republicans, because I've got bums in my own family. So you've got bums in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. I mean, everywhere you go, there's a 20% bum factor. But in this particular case, it is accurate to say that certain Republicans and certain Tea Party candidates are using fear. This was really going on. They're using fear to drive a stake between those who believe they once had and those who believe that some new group is taking from them, or somehow that entitlement payments and even though the largest entitlement is Social Security, and even though food stamps came from white Americans, not anybody else, and even though there's more poor white in America, poor whites in America than poor anybody else, still these fear tactics work. I think that this is part of what I'm trying to articulate against. The only thing I'm against is having no plan. The only thing I'm against is being an expert in what you're against. And we've got to figure out what we're for. My book articulates a common sense plan of what you can be for and how we can actually make this economy work for us and stop picking scapegoats. You know, after World War One, Germany felt embarrassed and humiliated, and it was that humiliation and that economic isolation and that fear that then drove them to persecute the Jews. I mean, the Jews were just their neighbors before that. They were your merchants. They were your bankers. All of a sudden, it became those Jews. This is as old as the ages. This is not something unique to America. And it's a universal theme. Riding on fear and riding on what you're against and picking somebody who's your problem because you can't figure out what the solution is. And what I have tried to do in this book is to unpack these myths. For instance, you don't need to go to the southern states to find people who are so-called poor. You're living in L.A., you make less than $50,000 a year, you are struggling to make ends meet. I don't care whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow, you want to see some more green. You go to New York City, you make less than $70,000 a year, you're struggling to make ends meet. You go to here in Atlanta, $40,000 a year. I grew up in L.A., but here in Atlanta, $40,000 a year. You're struggling to make ends meet. That's half of America, and that's not 40 million or 25 million or 25%. That's half of America, $50,000 a year or less. But this same group is also driving the $17 trillion economy. This same group are putting 90 cents of every dollar they make back into the economy and unbeknownst to them, driving the largest economy in the world. Every rich company or big company was once a small one. And most wealth was created by some immigrant or some other person who was once poor, who had a vision for something and made it real. So wealth, it does not come from the wealthy. Sam Walton drove a pickup truck. You know, what's the largest retailer in the world today? Walmart, the guy who created UPS, $100 investment. The guy who created Coca-Cola, $100 investment. I mean, these are immigrant stories. They are people who are strivers. It is the best of America, and I just choose to look at the facts. And the facts say that today, 70% of all jobs come from businesses with 500 employees or less. And half of all jobs come from businesses with 100 employees or less. Now, that's not big business in Wall Street. That's your street. That's my street.
Again, I'm speaking with John Hope Bryant, the founder, chairman, and CEO of Operation Hope and Bryant Group Companies. He was appointed by President Obama in 2014 as a member of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans and also co-founded the Gallup Hope Index, the only national research poll on youth financial dignity and youth economic energy in the United States. His latest book just out is How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. So, and by the way, the government sets the income for four Americans, a household of four Americans, to the poverty threshold is $23,850 a year. So, you know, what you just told us, it's a pretty extraordinary to think anybody can live on that kind of money, particularly four people. So let's then get into the idea of what we should be doing here in terms of empowering Americans to bring back a fairer and more just economy. Are you suggesting that because the majority of us are consumers, that we should act in a way as, you know, being more conscious about what we buy? Should corporations be graded upon their humanity and their decency?
Well, that is one approach, and that's not a new approach. It's actually not the central premise of my book, but it deserves to be noted that Dr. King's movement and the Civil Rights Movement, which was about all Americans and not black Americans, that he went in and marched and, you know, shut down the economy, basically, and told the people not to get on the buses because they couldn't sit where they wanted to. Well, we didn't realize that 80% of the customers in that little small town were black. So the bus company went broke in 9 months. Now, they weren't trying to bankrupt the bus company. It was not punitive. It just so happens that it became punitive for bad economics. And it was Andrew Young, my mentor, who wrote the foreword on this book, who was sent in by Dr. King to go negotiate with business leaders, not the politicians, about, you know, 6 or 8 weeks into the march, to negotiate, you know, a standstill agreement. And it got more than that. The merchants decided to take the whites-only signs down. Now, Ian, this is interesting. It wasn't government that took the signs down. It wasn't universities that took the signs down. In 1955, 1960, It was free enterprise and capitalism. It was business leaders. It was JCPenney's and Woolworths and all these little department stores and soda shops that took the signs down first. And so once again, there's free enterprise and capitalism playing, and it happened in South Africa as well. It was economic pressures that got them to act right. Now, I don't think that that is a leading edge strategy. We should acknowledge our strength, and Donald Sterling, had all these black players, and here he is making very salty remarks about black people. Well, he's in a bad strait now. He'll do well economically because the team that is led by black players is a wealthy team, but his reputation is in tatters. The thing he values the most, his reputation, is done. He's toast. And that's what he has been trying to buy for 20 years was a good name. And now that's lost forever. I do believe that there are two primary themes, though. Theme number one is recognize you already have power. They cannot recognize that the 99% is not a negative. It's a net positive. And I'll get to my definition of poverty, if you want me to, in a moment, which I think dovetails with that, because it's not 23,000 blah, blah, blah a year. That's what the government has a legal obligation to tell you what it is. And the second piece of that, though, is building wealth. In my book, I talk about a young man, actually a middle-aged guy. I assumed he was a teacher. He came to me to sign some notary documents at my house on a mortgage. And being presumptuous, oh, you're a teacher, you're doing this part-time. No, I do it full-time. Anyway, you find out he's got a $36 notary stamp from the city of Atlanta. He makes $17,000 a month, Ian, in a mobile notary business. And he's got 200 contract employees, contractors he contracts with, that are also mobile notaries. Now, he's creating wealth, he's creating jobs, he's creating opportunity, but he created that for himself. And the guy whose suit that I'm wearing right now, we gave him a $35,000 loan, raised his credit score 120 points, gave him a lesson in financial literacy, the language of money, entrepreneurship. Guy's now doing between $500,000 and $800,000 a year in business, in six employees, raising his taxes, paying for his children's education. He lives right there in L.A., drove clothing. Now, he's been doing that for 10 years. If I had given a homeless guy $1 million, he'd be broke in 6 months with the best of intentions. I gave this guy a $35,000 investment and believed in his economic energy, gave him the tools to do for himself, and he's adding to the payrolls, the tax base, the responsible citizen roles, the voter roles of this great city of Los Angeles. And there are countless examples like this. But we don't recognize our own power. What America needs now is 1 million startups a year just to solve almost all of our problems, mostly job-related, because that's where all job growth comes from. Startups, small business owners, entrepreneurs. And for the first time since 1978, Ian, we got more small business deaths in America than small business starts. 350,000 starts and 400,000 small business deaths. That was 2011 census numbers. First time since 1978. That's us believing all this crap that America is on the decline, and we focus on the wrong thing. We're focusing on our arguments and our differences, and we focus on this hype that Wall Street and big business is driving our economy. That's just wrong. There's only 974 companies in America that employ 10,000 people or more, and they aren't hiring. There's 18,000 businesses between 1,000 and 10,000 employees, and I've already said that 70% of all jobs come from employees with 500 employees or less. So if we're dogging business, we're dogging the neighborhood grocery store, we're dogging the gas station and the architect and the dentist. And I mean, you think about where we go every day, every week. It's 10 people, 6 people, 4 people, then most the restaurant, 20 people. That's what's driving the American economy. But what do we tell our kids, Ian? Go to school K through 12, great, graduate, great. Go to college, get a bunch of student loan debt. Don't do that, but go to college. And then go work for a big company or big business, neither of which are hiring.
Well, I think you've made the point that there's this vast untapped arena out there of small business. But in terms of some of what you're offering up here in your new book, John Hope Bryant, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, you mentioned credit. How do people, the current credit score, you argue, keeps people in poverty?
Yeah, well, half of employers require a credit check before they'll hire you, as an example. And if you go into a neighborhood in a Latino neighborhood, a poor black neighborhood, if it's in rural America, a white neighborhood outside of a military base, you'll find a check cashier next to a payday loan lender, next to a rent-to-own store, next to a title lender, next to a liquor store. That's not racism. It's target marketing. They're targeting a 500 credit score customer. That's the legacy of financial literacy. And we never got the memo on financial literacy, on the language of money, which hopefully I'll get to in a moment, which goes back to 1865 and President Lincoln, and the act that nobody even knows that he signed. But what I'm going to do is rob those payday lenders of their customers. I'm moving credit scores 120 points on average over 18 to 24 months. It's not rocket science. It's just simply being a private banker to the working man and focusing on their potential. And when you move somebody, nothing changes your life more than God or love than moving your credit score 120 points. And when you move it 74 points, the young lady who couldn't get a job goes back and gets that job. It's Ebony Brown. You move it 120 points. That's Ryan Taylor and Drove Clothing. And that his chest is out, his head is up, his financial IQ comes up, which goes into, by the way, the definition of poverty. Half low self-esteem. It's just lack of belief in yourself. I can tell on this phone call you believe in yourself. You have high esteem. If you don't believe in who you know, you don't know who you are by 9 in the morning, by 9 at night, somebody's going to tell you. You are toast in this country if you don't know who you are and you don't believe in yourself. That's half of poverty. The second part is role modeling, or the lack thereof, and environment. You hang around 9 broke people, you'll be the 10th. If all you see in your neighborhood are rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers, that's what you want to be. Why is anybody surprised if that's all they see? They don't see entrepreneurs and business owners. And the last part is aspiration, code word for hope, and opportunity. So if I don't see any opportunity at the end of education, I'm going to drop out of school. So we're not connecting education with aspiration. I basically, Ian, I'm saying we're digging in the wrong holes. And to the extent that we're saying to people that poverty is a financial number, it's that $23,000 number you mentioned. Okay, we're missing the boat because people who make $50,000 a year and who are professionals feel poor today. And they're wondering whether their children are going to do as well as they did. We're also missing the fact that that middle-class parent or middle-class family saw their neighbor get laid off, saw their father get laid off. Maybe their confidence is down. Their confidence in themselves is in the toilet. They're reading all these stupid reports saying America is done. They're starting to feed into that crap. So all of a sudden it becomes a self-perpetuating loop, and thoughts become things. So poverty is as much, if not more, internal and environmental as anything else. And so we've simply reverse-engineered poverty and put together a plan to put together a network of, like a Starbucks of financial inclusion, 1,000 locations that are private bankers for the working poor inside of bank branches, grocery stores, credit unions. We have 100 up so far in the last 250 days. And then putting hope. Business in the Box academies and public schools to nurture economic energy for young people so we can find the next dang on Steve Jobs because they're there. But we have no system to find them, no system to nurture them. It's like the largest economy in the world is just sort of winging it.
Well, John Hope Bryant, I appreciate you joining us here today.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks for pushing the envelope and pushing me.
Well, thank you for pushing us all. Again, I've been speaking with John Hope Bryant, the founder, chairman, and CEO of Operation Hope and Bryant Group Companies, recognized as one of Time Magazine's 50 for the Future Leaders. Bryant is the author of Love Leadership and is the only African-American best-selling business author. He was appointed by President Obama in 2014 as a member of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans and is also the co-founder of the Gallup Hope Index, the only national research poll on youth financial dignity and youth economic energy in the United States. And his latest book just out is How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.